Episode 10, Two Old White Guys with the Audacity and Arrogance to Discuss Racism in America. This episode is entitled, The Historical Persecution of Jews. And we ask the question, why do people still hate Jews? On the night of August 12th, 2017, shortly after I completed my work day in Richmond, Virginia, just an hour's drive away in Charlottesville, protesters and counter-protesters rallied around the Thomas Jefferson statue at the University of Virginia campus. This followed months of heated debate after the city council had voted earlier in the year to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee, which had been installed almost a century ago in a nearby park. The city also voted to rename Lee Park, where the statue stands, and another nearby park named for Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. The removal of Confederate statues had been gaining momentum for years, and the issue gained widespread attention after the June 17, 2015 mass shooting at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The shooter was said to have glorified the Confederate South, posing in Facebook photos with the battle flag of Northern Virginia Army, which is also known now as the Confederate flag. Protests around the removal of the Confederate statues was not new. What was shocking on that August night was that the roughly 100 protesters were white nationalists who marched that night carrying tiki torches and chanting Nazi slogans, including Sieg Heil, Jews will not replace us, and Blood and Soil, which is the English translation of a Nazi slogan, all the while giving the Nazi salute. At one point during Friday night's rally, a brawl broke out when the white supremacists surrounded a small group of counter-protesters who were peacefully gathering at the Thomas Jefferson statue. The following day, 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed by a white supremacist while she protested a rally of the alt-right groups. I began this episode with the example from 2017 as a part of a national trend that has led to the largest number of anti-Semitic incidents since the Anti-Defamation League began tracking them in 1979. Nationwide, the ADL has recorded that anti-Semitic incidents have increased from 1,267 in 2016 to over 2,700 in 2021. This is Bob Villa from Florida, and along with my co-host Rob Comas, welcome you to our next episode. Welcome, Rob.
Welcome, Bob, to another episode. Good to see you. Well, hear from you.
In this episode, we're taking a look at anti-Semitism and asking the very poignant question, why have Jews been historically persecuted? And we're asking this question specifically because we want to know why so many people here in America still hate Jews. So Rob, start us off.
In the early 2000s, quote, anti-Semitism, an assault on human rights, end quote, a publication of the Jacob Blaustein Institute for the Advancement of Human Rights, authored by Anthony Julius, Robert S. Rifkin, Jeffrey Wheel, and Felice D. Garr, surveyed the history and forms of anti-Semitism and explored its various manifestations over the last two millennia. The report was submitted to the United Nations World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. The logic behind the report was that to understand racism, it seemed important to study anti-Semitism as, quote, perhaps the most ancient and persistent manifestation, end quote, of persecution of a people. In this episode, we thought that we were going to begin to research and search for answers to the following two questions. Are the Jewish people historically the most persecuted people? And two, if so, why? Well, actually, Bob, these are two questions I've personally grappled with for many years. And now that we are researching and confronting the issues head on, I realize they really aren't the questions I believe are most critical. I mean, who cares who is the most persecuted, right? Any persecution is still persecution. And as Martin Luther King Jr. said, quote, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, end quote. So I think I can reduce this to one question. Why have the Jews been persecuted century after century for thousands of years?
When Rob and I were first talking about doing a podcast on anti-Semitism, I found an article entitled Persecution of the Jews During the Great Plagues of the 14th Century by Courtney Dinkins from Montana State University, from their website. And I sent it to Rob. And Rob, why don't you go ahead and talk about what you found?
One of the references she cited, the previously mentioned anti-Semitism and assault on human rights, turned out to be a goldmine of information about anti-Semitism. And I believe it does a great job of answering our question, or at least starting to answer the question. We would like to share our research based on this article. As this is a lengthy report, this will constitute the first of several installments of our attempt to summarize the report.
The outline of the report is as follows, which is the forms of anti-Semitism, which include religious, political, and economic, racial discrimination against Jews, the persistence of anti-Semitism, the constant exclusionary anti-Semitism, and delusional anti-Semitism, which includes relevant international instruments and institutions.
Let us begin. In 2004, this was the time of the publication of the report, Jews made up a small percentage of all people. There were approximately 13 million Jews then, with 5.7 million in the U.S., less than 2% of the population, and 4.9 million in Israel, approximately 55% of the population. And the rest of the Jewish population was spread in relatively small numbers in the EU, Russia, Central South America, Africa, Oceania. As of 2022, there were approximately 15.3 million Jews out of roughly 8 billion humans on Earth, approximately 0.2%, a very small percentage of all people. The Jewish population originally was centered in what was ancient Israel, but Greek and later Roman military occupation geographically dispersed the Jewish people. The report states that, quote, nonetheless, the community's adherence to its distinctive folkways, the preservation of Hebrew as the language of religious liturgy, the memory of their national existence in ancient Israel, and their aspiration to return to Zion remained powerful centripetal forces in the life of the Jewish people, sustaining a sense of communal identity both among the devoutly religious and, in modern times, among relatively secularized Jews as well, end quote.
However, having distinctive cultural and religious practices also separated the Jews from what became predominantly Christian cultures and religions in Europe. And to a lesser extent, this also happened in the predominantly Islamic regions of the Iberian Peninsula. And this is one of the main drivers of continuing persecution of Jewish people all over the centuries. That which strengthened the Jews as a people, as a community, also made them the target of oppression as consistent candidates for, quote unquote, the other. The report states that so long as Jews remain committed to their own distinctive cultural and religious traditions, they present themselves as, in some sense, different from their non-Jewish neighbors. And quote, none of these developments made it inevitable that Jews would be persecuted. In each case, it was an open question whether the majority population and the governing authorities would treat a small and obviously vulnerable minority with tolerance for its differences and respect for humanity. And sometimes in places, such a liberal approach prevailed.
The report continues, quote, Muslim Spain during the 11th and 12th centuries, for example, left its Jews in peace and witnessed a flowering of Jewish life, making significant contributions both to Jewish culture and to the well-being of the larger communities among whom the Jews resided. The experience was, unfortunately, more the exception than the rule. The great enemies of tolerance, fear of what appears to be different or strange, the temptation to scapegoat, the opportunity to foster social solidarity by exclusion, all proved more than most societies could resist. In one form or another, hostility towards Jews became the policy of states and churches and the practice of peoples. End quote. In a rather striking and frightening conclusion to the report, the authors list in chronological order anti-Semitic laws, codes, and decrees. I tried counting the number of citations, but such was the volume that I soon lost track. Suffice to say, there were easily hundreds and perhaps more than 1,000 listed.
As a preface to the list, the report states that, quote, a prevailing theme of the attached paper is that Jews throughout history have been perceived of and treated as a perpetual outsider and a danger to the societies in which they live. While the intensity of anti-Semitism has at times subsided, history teaches that it always returns as well. One compelling proof of the Jews' pariah status throughout history is offered by official anti-Semitic state policies, which entrench discrimination and foster prejudice. What follows, in chronological order, is a sampling of anti-Semitic laws, edicts, legal decisions, papal rulings, and other examples of state policy that have existed for over the last 2,000 years. They demonstrate the persistence of official anti-Semitism throughout the world and the need for efforts to eradicate it.
These anti-Semitic policies were and are designed to, quote, push Jews to the margins of society, end quote. The policies marginalized and continue to marginalize the Jewish people through many means, including, quote, through discriminatory restrictions on religious observation, on political participation, vocation, education, residence, attire, and other denials of human rights. More extreme anti-Semitic laws have pushed Jews beyond the margins and excluded them from society even more irrevocably through expulsion and murder. End quote.
As noted earlier, the report looks at various forms of anti-Semitism: religious intolerance, political discrimination, economic exploitation, and racial discrimination. And while the boundaries between these categories is often blurry, these classifications bring some structure to such a broad topic. Additionally, in 1960, the American Jewish Committee wrote, "It should be borne in mind that anti-Semitism is cumulative rather than evolutionary, in the sense that it feeds on earlier sources of nourishment, even those which have lost their initial rationale," end quote. So seeing how the different forms and sources of anti-Semitism manifest themselves and feed off each other definitely seems worthwhile.
So today we begin with religious intolerance. As we begin this segment of the analysis, I am struck by the next comment made by William Nichols, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at the University of British Columbia. He, quote, concludes in his authoritative work, Christian Antisemitism, "No critical reader of the New Testament could easily come away with any but the most negative opinion of Jews. While the New Testament does not encourage racist views, for these were the invention of later periods, it sees little hope for Jews except in the conversion to Christ, end quote. In the future, we will research if other scholars agree with this assessment. Regardless of what the Bible says, Christian theologians, priests, bishops, and popes often articulated their own scathing views of the Jews. For example, quote, church theologians of the 4th and 5th centuries articulated an utterly degraded view of the Jews, end quote. Also, quote, John Chrysostom, Patriarch of Constantinople, likened them to dogs and wild animals, end quote. And, quote, he described the synagogue as a dwelling place of demons, end quote. The prominent Christian theologian St. Augustine talked about the Jews as, quote, those who, in the pride of their kingdom, put the Lord to death, end quote. And, quote, the church affirmed over the course of the centuries that there would be no respite for the Jew. The theology of collective guilt that held that the blood of Jesus falls not only on the Jews of that time, but on all generations of Jews up to the end of the world, end quote. With respect to Christianity, the concept of collective guilt surely has contributed significantly to regular and continued persecution of the Jews.
More specifically, quote, in the centuries following the establishment of Christianity in Europe, church doctrine characterized Jews as the murderers of Jesus and benighted deniers of Christ's revelation. The theology of contempt found its way into Christian liturgy, unquote. The Good Friday liturgy of the Roman Missal contained a prayer for the perfidious Jews and ask God to withdraw the veil from their hearts that they may acknowledge our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, while it is true that during the Second Vatican Council in 1965, this prayer was abolished, but removing a prayer after centuries of indoctrination does not undo the harm done, nor does it change the minds of those who are raised under the umbrella of statements like, as stated above, the blood of Jesus falls not only on the Jews of that time, but on all generations of Jews till the end of the world. Many more concrete examples of the discrimination against Jews that flow from this dogma can be found. Quote, a 1304 law in Spain and Portugal obligated Jews to pay a tax in memorial of the death of our Lord Jesus Christ when the Jews crucified him, end quote. Christian art throughout the centuries depicted distorted medieval figures of the Jews emblazoned on medieval frescoes, stained glass windows, monuments, and memorials, on illustrated Bibles, psalters, and prayer books. Jewish sacred books were banned and burned. In 1242, a papal bull of Pope Benedict XIII forbade Jews from listening to, reading, or teaching the Talmud in any Jewish book contradicting dogmas of Christianity, and they were banned. And in 1559, the governor of Milan burned thousands of copies of Talmud at the urging of the Dominicans.
Another form of religious anti-Semitism came in the form of forced conversion. Byzantine rulers imposed mass forced conversions on the Jews over five centuries. Three instances of this were: the Bishop of Majorca ordered one in 418. In 1582, the Merovingian king ordered all Jews in his kingdom to convert or else be blinded. In 1613, in Spain, Jews were ordered to be baptized or else they would be expelled. In 1492, in Spain again, between 40,000 and 100,000 Jews were ordered to convert or be expelled. And in 1827, in hopes of severing any ties to their Jewish community, Jewish boys were forced to serve 25 years in the military. Tsar Nicholas I hoped to turn young Jewish soldiers into good Christian Russians. The documentation provided by this journal article we find compelling. And in trying to more simply state how it is that people are century after century persecuted, I think perhaps I go back to the following. Quote, "The great enemies of tolerance, fear of what appears to be different or strange, the temptation to scapegoat, the opportunity to foster social solidarity by exclusion, all proved more than most societies could resist." End quote. At this point, we end our short summary of religious antisemitism.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Right now, we're going to do something a little different for us in this episode. We're going to be interviewing a colleague of mine here in South Florida. This is Ellis Bromberg, who belongs to the Jewish Reform Movement and who has followed our episodes, agreed to answer a few questions to help us along in our journey. Ellis is president of Bromberg Media Consulting. He's been in public broadcasting for over 40 years. Additionally, Ellis is the past president of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Milwaukee. Welcome, Ellis.
Thanks, Bob.
In our previous conversations, you've mentioned to me that your ancestors immigrated here in the 1800s. So talk about where they were from.
Well, again, thanks, Bob, and thanks, Rob, for having me on. Yeah, I have paternal grandparents and maternal grandparents. They both came to the United States well before the Second World War and so forth. My paternal grandparents did come here in the late 1800s, probably the 1890s. My paternal grandfather was born in Berlin, Germany, and my paternal grandmother was born in what is now Ukraine. My maternal grandparents came when they were teenagers. They came probably in the early 20th century, probably in the teens, before World War I, but in the teens, when they were teens. And they both came from what is now Belarus. I remember them saying that they were from White Russia. That's what they called it before they rechristened themselves Belarus. But yes, that's when they came.
So either through discussions with your grandparents or your parents or reading any family lore, did you ever know why they came here? Was it economic reason? Was it anti-Semitism where they were from?
You know, I've thought about this a lot since I've become more of an adult. And, I've kind of said, why didn't you ever have a real conversation with your grandparents when they were alive, obviously, about why they came here? And I don't think I ever did. So shame on me. But I think what I take away from this is, of course, I had a lot of conversations with my grandparents. They were alive when I was growing up, obviously. But this never came up. They did not dwell on it. And I think that's an important element to cite. I think that they were not focused on, oh my God, we had to escape from pogroms or anti-Semitism or oppression. I'm sure that they experienced that as Jews living in Ukraine or Belarus. I'm sure that they experienced that. But when they came to the United States, they loved this country, as we all do. And they saw America as a land of opportunity, and they did succeed. They mostly in the garment industry. My maternal grandparents, my paternal grandfather was a taxi cab driver in New York. But you know, they raised children, and they had those children had children, and we basically lived on the whole a good life. And I think that's what they took away. They did not dwell on whatever the heck happened in Europe and when they were young. They just saw America as a land of opportunity, and that's what they talked about.
Okay. Now I'm going to move a little bit forward into the 60s and 70s. I know from my own experience from reading that Jews were restricted from clubs or their membership was very limited. A joke that I remember from Groucho Marx when he was told that his daughter could not use a swimming pool at a fancy club, he stated, well, since she's only half Jewish, could she go up to her knees? Did any of your family members deal with or have to face this, being restricted from clubs or restaurants?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why I don't think that happened much. Something else with the Jewish experience in America, as well as the African-American experience in America. There were those restrictions. We knew about those restrictions. But both in the Jewish communities and to a certain extent in the African-American communities, they developed their own social structures. Because they might not be accepted into hotels or hospitals or country clubs, they developed their own social structures and social institutions. This is very much the case with the Jewish community. And I've read in the African-American community some work from Skip Gates, who's done a lot of work on PBS, how the African-American communities also did the same thing. So we developed our own. Okay, we're not going to be accepted into a hotel somewhere in upstate New York. So all the Catskill hotels became the Borscht Belt, and they catered to Jewish clients, and they had kosher menus and all that kind of stuff. So that's the way that we responded and adapted, and that's how it worked.
Throughout your years of being in public broadcasting, Ellis, I would assume that there were programs that highlighted the Jewish experience in America. Do you recall any negative feedback more than normal on these shows? And related to that, there are plenty of people who get offended when the phrase Happy Holidays is used as opposed to everyone having to say Merry Christmas. Did you get any blowback from that?
Okay, my experience in public television, had 40 years in public television, and a lot of that as a program director in upstate New York and in Illinois. PBS, public television, did produce a number of series about different ethnic groups, including Jewish Americans and Judaism in general. I did not get blowback from airing those programs. The one thing that I did get blowback from along that line, in a couple of instances, were programs about Israel. Israel is controversial now. It's always been controversial in many, many different ways. And even Jewish Americans, while strongly supportive of Israel, have complicated opinions on, for instance, the current Israeli government and so forth. Specifically, what I got blowback from, because you asked this question, were a couple of series that we acquired. They weren't produced by American producers, but they were produced by British producers or the BBC, in which they were historical pieces about the Israeli war for independence. And they, Britain, there's some wording that is used that is can be offensive to Jewish Americans. I disagree strongly with, but there are Arabs and Palestinians who believe that there were elements of ethnic cleansing in Israel's war against the Arab states to declare independence. And I strongly disagree with that. But the BBC used those words in their program. And we aired the programs, and a lot of my Jewish viewers called and said, how could you do that? That's not really accurate. So it's not a direct answer to your question, but that's the blowback that I got, but not specifically about, airing anything about Jewish Americans. Happy holidays. I haven't got any blowback on that, but the whole thing about it is I say happy holidays. When people say Merry Christmas to me, I say, and same to you. I do not use the phrase Merry Christmas because there are many people who do not celebrate Christmas. There are more than one holiday in December. And I was offended that President Trump made such a big deal about that as though it was, an insult to America or to Christian Americans that people would not say Merry Christmas. That's about all I can tell you about that.
Well, that's good. Thanks. And I want to move ahead even more to some relatively recent events that to me really opened a lot of eyes, certainly opened mine, to how rampant anti-Semitism remains in this country. I opened the episode with the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, back in 2017. Mm-hmm. And I was working an hour from there. It was pretty painful to watch. There were the groups that chanted racist and anti-Semitic slogans, carried weapons. And we know somebody was killed. And then, a year later, in October 2018, a man shouting anti-Semitic slurs opened fire inside of Pittsburgh's synagogue on a Saturday morning, killing at least 11 congregants. He was a member of GAB, a popular social network among the alt-right activists and nationalists. Do you see these and other recent events as a result of anything in particular?
Well, I do feel that I don't want to blame one man or one party for all of this, but I guess your listeners should know that I'm very much involved in the Democratic Party here in Southern Florida. And I do think that Donald Trump gave cover to people who hate and people who are, white nationalists and anti-Semitic. And when he said after Charlottesville, there are good people on both sides, that was very offensive and very troubling. And I do think that that gave cover. And in the last election, we saw, you mentioned there's a GAB. We saw Mastriano, the candidate for governor in Pennsylvania, align himself with that. And we've seen Donald Trump continue to dine with white nationalists and anti-Semites. So, yes, I mean, he has given cover to a lot of that, and it's very troubling.
Well, thanks. I want to get back to specifically to you. And I read an article recently, and if I mispronounce the name, you're going to correct me here,
okay,
by Rabbi Kalman Pakus.
Mm-hmm.
So quoting him here, for the last 2,000 years, the Jewish people have gone through enormous amounts of persecution, hatred, ultimately leading to genocide. And through it all, Jewish people always held on to being Jewish. And the reason why is that they really understand that it was worth it. They understand what the meaning of being Jewish was, and they were willing to pay a price. So, two parts of my question. What does being Jewish mean to you? And second, has it changed or evolved over your lifetime?
I believe Judaism is very meaningful to me. Being a Jew, it's my religion. It's also my people. My people. I think that principles, preachings of Judaism as a religion speak to me. The ethics, the notion of we are here to repair the world. It's a notion, particularly in Reform Judaism. I think the ethics of the religion speak to me. That's not to say that if I had not been raised Catholic, I wouldn't be a very proud and happy Catholic. I was raised Jewish. I've had Jewish friends all my life, and it's been very meaningful to me. I believe in God. I think I have a relationship with God through my religion. So it's a tough question to answer, but it's meaningful to me. Second part of that question,
Has it evolved over your lifetime?
I don't think that my interaction with the religion has changed dramatically. I've been this way all my life. Judaism has evolved, particularly in America. When I was growing up, there was more conservative or Orthodox Jews, and there's been more intermarriage, the more progressive notions. If you read the old prayer books, they're very the direct readings of the Torah refer to God in a masculine sense. You read the new prayer books, they do not refer to he or to Lord. They take all that out and they will only refer to God or sovereign or whatever. So we don't believe that God is a specific gender. And if you read the old prayer books, that wasn't the case, but they've evolved in that way.
Sure.
And typically now, if you go to a particularly a reform service, including ours here in Port St. Lucie, the rabbi will bring out a guitar when he does his service. That didn't happen when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s.
Okay. Now, getting down to the question I've been really wanting to ask. And we began the episode with it. And don't worry, I'm not asking you to answer on behalf of the entire Jewish population. But here it is. Why do you feel that so many people, more specifically, why do you think and feel that so many Americans still hate Jews?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how many hate Jews. I think that there certainly is anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitic acts have been on the rise, as you have both pointed out. I had an experience when I was between junior high school and high school, and there are some experiences that I've read about in some books, including a book that I would recommend called G.I. Jews, which talks about Jewish servicemen during World War II. And my experience was in a national contest, the National Oratorical Contest, along with kids from all over the United States. And that's when I was a teenager. And the contest was in Portland, Oregon. And I represented New York State in the contest. So it was no girls, it was all guys in those days, it was all boys. And we spent like a week in Portland. We went through the competition, but we also traveled around Portland. And a lot of these guys said, I've never met a Jew before. I've just never met a Jew before. And they asked, how can you explain the fact that the Jews killed Jesus? I mean, hey, I was a teenage kid and I had to defend Judaism from 2,000 years ago about whether we killed Jesus or not. I think in the G.I. Jews, they talk about the fact that there are so many servicemen who are serving with Jews from all over the country who'd never met a Jew before. There were these things from centuries about Jews killing Jesus or Jews being odd or keeping to themselves or whatever conspiratorial notions there were about Jews, whatever. And, you know, people just were uninformed. They didn't know, and they went along with preconceived notions that were unfair, and they still persist to this day. They just don't know who you are. You're different. They've never met you. And I think we're only 2% of the population in the United States. So there's that. I think it's not only us. And if you're a Hindu American, if you're a Sikh American, if you're an African American in certain parts of the country, it's the same thing. So.
Okay. So we have a couple more minutes, and we thank you for stopping by. You and your synagogue have something very special coming up that when you were telling me about it before, I was just totally amazed because I'd not heard the backstory, but I think this would be very important to briefly talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Synagogue it's in Port St. Lucie, Florida. It's Temple Beth El Israel. We are welcoming, it's on April 15th, a new Torah scroll to our synagogue and to the community. This is what we call an orphan Torah scroll. Where does this come from? During World War II, during the Holocaust, and even before synagogues were decimated by the Nazi regime, which happened, the Nazis had this notion. They asked synagogues, they directed synagogues to send their Torahs and other religious objects to a warehouse, basically, in Prague, in what is now the Czech Republic. They had a notion here. They were intending to eliminate the Jewish population in Europe, obviously. In the early days, they were hoping to just ship them all out. But then, of course, they turned to extermination. But they had a notion that they were going to set up in Prague a museum, which was going to be called a museum to an extinct race. They intended to wipe out all the Jews and house all these religious objects in what is the oldest synagogue, and it's still standing in Prague. It's called the Altneu Shul. It's a Gothic synagogue in Prague. And you heard that's what they were going to call it. They were going to house all these people. They were going to eliminate all the Jews and, you know, show off these objects that they had seized from the Jews. Now, there were about 1,500 Torahs that they had seized. Those sat in a warehouse in Prague after World War II until the 60s, when they were acquired by a trust based in London to repatriate these Torah scrolls. Temple Beth El Israel is welcoming one of these Torah, has acquired one of these Torah scrolls, and we are going to have a welcoming ceremony in April 15th. Going to march the Torah into the synagogue. It's going to be a program in which we will, our rabbi and other community leaders will talk about anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, the meaning of this Torah and this whole event. Wow. So we hope members of the community will show up for that. And it's a very exciting and, in some ways, heartbreaking, but also important event to note.
It's something I'd never heard of before. And thank you for bringing that to our attention, because mm-hmm. The results of the Holocaust continue on and on, and, mm-hmm. and I guess the phrase "never forget." Unfortunately, some people have forgotten, but this is a good way not to forget. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Alice. Before we close up shop and send you on your merry way, you've brought a couple of books that we could mention. It's always good for Rob and I to have more resources and to pass them on to some of our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bob, you mentioned when we were setting this up, you might want me to mention a couple of books. And there are a few that I have read. One that I just referred to earlier in the conversation, I'll refer to again, G.I. Jews, which tells the story about Jewish servicemen during World War II. This was really an eye-opening event. Many Jews served in World War II. All my father, my grandparents, my uncles all served in World War II. And this was a very eye-opening experience for the Jews serving, but also the non-Jews serving. The book also explains how there was still anti-Semitism among the servicemen, including a fascinating event in which they had an ecumenical service.
Right.
An ecumenical service. But the ecumenical service turned out to be only for Christian clergymen. They would not allow the rabbi to participate in the ecumenical service. Why? Because the rabbi had spoken out about racism and the need to integrate the army. It's a real good book.
This is called G.I. Jews, How World War II Changed a Generation by Deborah Moore. Okay.
Yeah. What else? And really how it changed the impressions of Jews to non-Jews and non-Jews to Jews too. This is very specifically written during the Trump administration, and it's called Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump by Jonathan Weissman. And that's basically what it is. It talks about the fact that they're online, all of a sudden, these anti-Semitic tweets and posts were showing up, and people, there was no filter. People felt it was, Semitism is written with three, what do you call them, around them?
Parentheses.
Three parentheses around them, because I think, as I recall, it's been a couple of years since I've read the book, the notion was when people were tweeting anti-Semitic notions and they were saying, you know, people say it's anti-Semitic. They would put
air quotes.
Air quotes. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. It's the equivalent of air quotes.
Yeah.
So
okay.
He writes. You know,
that's a good one.
The other one that I'm actually just reading now, but it's I'm halfway through it, and it's terrific. It's called Bad Jews, A History of American Jewish Politics and Identities by Emily Tamkin. What is meant by bad Jews? Now, this is very much an internal Jewish thing, but talking about Trump, Trump made some comments when he was in office and out of office about the fact that American Jews were not always totally supportive of Israel and not totally supportive of Donald Trump.
Right.
So it was actually the evangelical Christians who were more supportive of Israel. And this is the notion that you guys, you're bad Jews. But within the Jewish community, this notion, it talks about this notion of who's a good Jew and who's a bad Jew. When you talk about, we talk about, when I was growing up, when there was, criminal who had a Jewish last name, my mother would always say, oh, I hope he's not Jewish. I hope he's not Jewish. It probably goes on in other communities too.
Yeah.
Italian mother, I hope he's not Italian.
Yeah.
It happened in our community. And there were a number of Jews who had important positions in the Trump administration. I mean, you know, Miller and Mnuchin and, they were, what's his name?
Yeah.
The son-in-law.
His son-in-law.
We were, as a lot of Jewish people who are mostly progressive liberal Jews, were embarrassed by this, the fact that these were Jews. So there are a lot of chapters about my experience growing up in the 50s and 60s in the suburbs of New York City about what my life was. And so I'm finding it very interesting.
Wow. Okay. Well, Ellis, this has been very enlightening for me. You know, in the time we've known each other, we've had some good discussions. Certainly enlightening for Rob and I as we take this journey that we started a couple of years ago trying to understand racism. And as our opening quote, Lisa, that we really can't understand racism until we understand anti-Semitism, or anti-Semitism is where so much of this began. And for us, this is a good segue from our other episodes to this. So thank you very much. We look forward to maybe reading some of these books. And Thanks again. And good luck on the 15th. It sounds like an amazing, amazing event.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. And thanks, Rob. Thank you very much.
Before we conclude, we want to swing back with some further discussion regarding the Catholic Church's Vatican II from the 1960s and where we are today. During World War II, Angelo Roncalli was the Vatican's ambassador to Turkey. There, he helped many Jews escape the Nazis by issuing false baptismal papers. Roncalli became Pope John XXIII in 1958, and in 1962, he convened the Second Vatican Council to bring the Church into the modern world. He wanted to end what had been called centuries of contemptuous Church teaching about the Jews.
There was much obstruction. Some bishops even handed out anti-Jewish leaflets in St. Peter's Square. But in 1965, 2 years after John XXIII's death, Nostra Aetate was finally issued. Rabbi David Rosen, interreligious affairs director for the American Jewish community, says it was truly a revolutionary document. Quote, "That took us from a situation where the Jewish people were seen as cursed and rejected by God, and even in the league with the devil, to a situation where now popes say it's impossible to be a true Christian and to be an anti-Semite, and that the covenant between God and the Jewish people is an eternal covenant, never broken." End quote.
Yeah, it really was a huge deal. As the Catholic Church acknowledged for the first time that Jesus is the link between Christianity and Judaism, says church historian Massimo Fagioli. In this document, he says, the Catholic Church accepted the idea that Christians don't own Jesus. He said, that is theologically revolutionary, because in the Catholic mindset, Jesus was a Catholic. By itself, this document should have been the end-all and be-all for Catholics. However, for many, it's not been. In 2007, the Southern Poverty Law Center documented 12 anti-Semitic traditionalist Catholic groups that continue to preach anti-Semitic hatred. And of special note is E. Michael Jones, the publisher of a magazine entitled Culture Wars. The title story for the January 2023 issue, just 2 months ago, is entitled The Jewish Racket Known as the Right to Life Movement.
Jones started down the road of radical traditionalism in 1981 when he founded Fidelity Magazine after being fired as a professor at South Bend's Catholic Women's College, St. Mary's. Jones runs through all the usual anti-Semitic canards, the ideas that Jewish media elites run the country, that Jews are major players in pornography, and that Jews are behind Masonry and French Revolution. Jones's anti-Semitic writings are premised on the idea that Catholic doctrine obligates the faithful to oppose Judaism, regardless of the behavior of the individual Jew. The Vatican and most Catholics have thoroughly repudiated anti-Semitism, but Jones still declares himself to be a defender of normative Catholic teachings. Jones's contention that his beliefs have theological foundations may give him a degree of legitimacy amongst some Catholics who would otherwise be dismissive of his extremist conclusions.
Unfortunately, his anti-Semitic views have an audience even beyond the borders of the United States. On January of this year, he was interviewed on Iranian TV, and he said that the most fundamental problem in America politics is Jewish control over the government and foreign policy, end quote. So the preaching of anti-Semitism goes on. In future episodes, we will discuss the other forms of anti-Semitism described in the text, Anti-Semitism, an Assault on Human Rights Report. We leave you with this. Here in Florida, just this past January alone, the following anti-Semitic incidents were reported. Anti-Semitic flyers were distributed to residential driveways.
Anti-Semitic symbols were spray painted on the wall of a high school bathroom.
Swastikas were spray painted on the side of a Walgreens store.
Individuals associated with the Goyim Defense League distributed anti-Semitic propaganda in a residential area.
And a swastika, a crossed out Star of David, and a homophobic slur were painted at a golf course. So, thanks for tuning in to Two Old White Guys with the Audacity and Arrogance to discuss racism in America. And our special thanks to our guest, Ellis Bromberg. Rob?
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Ellis. Thank any of you who are listening for listening. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.